Since tomorrow is Halloween, I thought I would talk a little bit about hungry ghosts. Halloween is kind of a day, I guess, to celebrate or acknowledge that which is usually unseen, the unseen ghosts and goblins, and the unseen and unspoken fears that we have. And the history of Halloween that probably many of you know is that the way it's often described, it was a Catholic holiday in England that was co-opted the earlier Celtic holiday for the fall harvest period, kind of the change of the year. The new year started November 1st for the Celts, I guess, about. And it was a day to remember the death of one year, deaths, people of old, ancient people, dead people. And I guess it was a very important holiday. And so the Catholic Church, when they came to England, made it into All Saints Day. And here in America, some Buddhist groups have, not so much trying to co-opt Halloween now, but have seen that there's a wonderful harmony between Halloween and some Buddhist celebrations that do the same thing, that celebrate the dead, celebrate the hungry ghosts, and the unseen, unspoken demons and fears and various things that we have. This weekend, I was leading a retreat and I want to tell you about a couple of the people that I had interviews with. There were two people in the group who were part of another sangha, another meditation group, that had been meditating together, sitting together weekly on a weekly basis for about 7 years in someone's home, a small sitting group. And things had gotten, the group was in the process of getting more or less a divorce. And it was very, very painful. They had all kinds of difficult issues that come up and they hadn't been able to work them out together. And people were furious at each other and felt unsafe in the group and were leaving and not coming back. And the two women that I met, they were kind of the founders of the group. So it was a very difficult and painful time for them. And so they wanted to talk about the pain. And one of the women talked about her anger at what the group had become was different than what she expected. And she talked about her anger and was wondering what to do about her anger. And I asked her how the pain of the situation, how the anger made her feel. And she said, "It makes me feel very lonely, very alone." And so we talked about her aloneness and loneliness. And it turned out that the reason she started the group was to try to kind of find some place to take care of her aloneness. And aloneness was kind of a very important ancient, old pattern in her life. And she wanted to, the sitting group, she was her attempt to try to overcome her aloneness. So it wasn't simply that she was alone now at the end of 7 years, but she was alone at the beginning also. And it was kind of a theme. So I asked her to spend some time just being with her aloneness and sensing it and feeling it. And what was there together with the aloneness? And what was there, to her surprise, was a tremendous amount of fear. And she didn't know she had it. And then I made the observation to her that aloneness was a very important issue for her, but she had she was thinking the aloneness had to do with other people. And she had been alone to herself, in that she had all this fear that she hadn't been in touch with before. And so a core part of who she was, a core part of how she organizes herself, had to do with this fear and the aloneness. But the aloneness was kind of the result of the fear, the kind of holding back from the fear, holding back from herself. So she was alone from herself as much as she was felt alone from other people. And that was the unseen voice, the unseen hungry ghost of her life that she saw was the fear that she had deep inside of herself. So suddenly the way she looked at the whole situation changed. rather than being furious at the others, she thought, oh, maybe it's more interesting for me to look at myself, because there's a huge part of myself which has gone unlooked at for a long time. The other woman I talked to also had a lot of pain and anger over the breakup of the group. And she was very upset about that the group was unwilling to meet together to try to talk about what had happened, talk about the pain and the anger, and felt the betrayal that had happened. So we talked about it for a while. And at some point, she stated that there were some people in the group, two people in the group, who she didn't really want to be present in the group because she felt unsafe around them. And then I pointed out to her that the very thing that she felt upset about, that the group wouldn't meet to kind of meet her with her pain, she was doing to someone else in the group, saying, I don't want those people to be present. And she hadn't made the connection that the very thing that she was most upset about, she was doing in turn. And when I kind of mirrored that for her, that suddenly she stopped. And she was wondering then, what is going on here with me? And what's going on with the situation? And here was the kind of the unseen or the unspoken side of the situation which she was beginning to acknowledge and see. Another woman in this group, I talked on Saturday about anger some. We had a discussion about anger. And she, as many people often do, she wanted to know about the anger she felt for Bosnia, you know, Yugoslavia. And so we talked about such things a little bit. And then in her interview that I had with her, we talked about her relationship with her brother mostly. The next day she came back on Sunday to the group, and she announced that she had thought the anger was about Bosnia, but it turned out it was about her brother. And there was this huge, unseen, unacknowledged part of her life which was affecting how she saw the world and her projections in the world and her responses to the world. But she hadn't seen it before. And now she saw it had to do with her brother, the anger she had for her brother. And then there was one more person, another woman, who came, and she had been kind of new to Buddhist practice, but had done many years of shamanic practice. That was kind of her main practice. And was very interested in altered states of mind and altered states, and was very eager to kind of be engaged in Buddhism to continue having altered states, and was having some certain kinds of altered states. But she felt a little bit disoriented and wanted some kind of reassurance that where she was going and the state she was attaining were, you know, she wanted to be reassured in them, that they fit, that they had meaning, that there was a path and everything. So she asked me for that, and I said, well, I told her that I think it would be a disservice if I reassured you. And that's kind of surprised. That got her attention. And I think it would be a disservice to you. And so I asked her, why do you want to be reassured? And she said, oh, because I don't want to waste my time. I want to know that I'm going somewhere. And so we talked about that for a while, hung out with that for a while, and I asked her where that fear of wasting time arose out of in her, where she could feel it in her body, how it was. And she said, well, it's anxiety. I feel anxiety all the time. And what she was doing was she was trying to escape her anxiety through her spiritual practice. And that was her unseen voice, her unseen, the unspoken fears. And that wasn't something even to be looked at. I mean, to be considered, she was just kind of gung ho on doing her spiritual practice without any sensitivity to the motivation behind it and where that motivation arose out of. So Halloween is a time where we invite these unspoken, unheard aspects of ourselves and of the world around us, the unseen world. And the unseen world is a wide world, it's a huge world. It's the unseen, it's the people. Often in Buddhism, it's a time to celebrate and remember, to remember, reconnect with the people who have died. And often they celebrate or they remember as part of the ceremony the people who died in the last year. But also to remember, sometimes it's to remember the lineage, the Buddhists, the practitioners who have gone back, your elders, who go back through history and back through time, who brought us here and support us here, the unseen forces that bring us here, but also the unseen within us, the unseen fears, the unseen anxieties and hungry ghosts that we are. So in one Zen center where they do a ceremony, they start the ceremony with an invocation. Welcome, hungry ghosts. Be at ease, the vaguely known, the unconscious and unknown. Welcome and be safe. And a hungry ghost in Buddhism is a being that has a very, very, very narrow throat and a very, very, very large stomach. And there's no way you can get enough food down that narrow, narrow throat to fill that huge stomach. So a hungry ghost is always craving. It's always dissatisfied. And basic idea is the hungry ghost is someone who's constantly dissatisfied and thirsting and wanting for things. And you find in Buddhist paintings, you know, depictions of these kinds of people, narrow throats and big stomachs. But one way of understanding this is that there are certain people who are hungry ghosts, or each of us at different times are hungry ghosts. Our unsatisfied nature, our thirsting, wanting something. It's a kind of wanting, a kind of unsatisfactory sense or feeling where you can never get enough, no matter how much you get. So these women who had the sitting group, this first one especially, who had this loneliness, was trying to fill her aloneness with the sitting group. She actually could never get enough from the sitting group. The sitting group could never really provide enough, because she was trying to fill something which can't be filled from outside. And she got some reassurance and some help from it, but it was like trying to fill this huge empty stomach with a narrow throat. So part of what happens in Buddhist ceremonies of Halloween-like ceremonies of inviting the hungry ghosts up is part of it is then once you invite them, you feed them. And so there's usually food offerings. But what does it mean if we're the hungry ghost or aspects of ourselves as the hungry ghosts, what does it mean to feed them? How do we feed our emotions, our fears, our feelings, our desires, our wants? And that's something for each of us to figure out for ourselves. But one of the suggestions or imitations in mindfulness practice is we feed it with our awareness. That awareness is understood in Buddhism to be kind of a food. And if you bring awareness to a situation, you're kind of feeding it. But you need to bring the right kind of awareness. So there's a story from the time of the Buddha. It's given as a sutra, so in that sense it's supposed to have happened, but who knows. The story about, you know, there's all these gods in Buddhist cosmology. And the top honcho is this guy named Brahma. And he has this huge throne somewhere up there in the 33rd heaven. And he kind of presides over all the 33 heavens and all the deities there. And one day he was gone from his throne. And this little runt of a yaksha are these ugly little trolls, Indian trolls maybe, but they're kind of ugly and kind of mean-spirited. Trolls in Norway are kind of lovable and nice. But anyway, mean-spirited kind of little runt climbed up on the throne. And the other gods were furious, you know, this is reserved for the supreme god, you know, the pantheon of Indian gods. And what, you know, you shouldn't be up there. And so they started getting into an argument with him and yelling at him and saying, you shouldn't do that, and you should get off. And they were furious. And the more angry they got, the bigger and more beautiful, more radiant this yaksha became. And so they didn't know what to do. So finally they went and found Brahma and said, you know, help us. What's going on here? And he came to the scene and explained. that this was a kind of a being, this yaksha was a kind of being that fed on people's anger. And the more angry you get, the more food he was got, and the more radiant and energized and everything he got, and bigger he would get. And then what you needed to do was not get angry, but to show your respect. So Brahma went in and prostrated himself to the yaksha, and honoring it. And as he did that, the yaksha became smaller and smaller and smaller until the yaksha disappeared. So I don't know if you know exactly what the moral is, but whether we're supposed to get rid of all these yakshas, but I think what's nice, the idea is that these hungry ghosts, these fears, these anxieties are not something to the quality of your awareness is important. You don't bring an awareness which hates it and tries to get rid of it, but you bring an awareness that respects it. And respect is really kind of a key word, I think, for mindfulness practice. Bring your respect. The word, there's a very popular word, I think, it was Jung the one who coined the word shadow? Yes? It was Jung? Anyway, it's become kind of a very common word in our culture, the idea of a shadow. And I think it works very well, the shadow, talk about this unseen part, the part that's unacknowledged. Because often if we emphasize one thing, that tends to create a shadow for the light of awareness. And so you don't see what's in the shadow. But it's almost inevitable we do that. It's very hard not to do that. And as soon as you have a preference and you have a want for something, you're kind of focusing and orienting yourself in one direction, and you're not paying attention to what's happening in the other direction. And reality in Buddhist philosophy is understood to be a constant process of change and adaptation. It's a codependent, a co-originating process. Who we are and what reality is and our experience of reality is constantly in flux and changing, and it's constantly being adapted by the influence of all things around it. Everything's being, it's a codependent origination, it's called in Buddhism. What this means is that there's nothing static. There's no single thing or no single position or single state of mind or single state of way of being which is the right way to be. Rather, the right way of being from Buddhist point of view is to be flexible, to be able to be adapted, to flow back and forth between different positions, different states of mind, different everything. Because if you don't have the flexibility, as soon as you take one stand in one position, you're going to create a shadow. But we inevitably take a position. We inevitably take a view or an opinion about what where we're at or what's going on, and then we inevitably then create a shadow. It's very, very common. So how do we illuminate the shadow? How do we bring it out? Well, that's what Halloween is for. And maybe it's unfortunate we only get to do it one day out of a year. But to reflect, to spend some time reflecting, what are the unseen forces? What are the unseen movements? What are the hungry ghosts? What are the fears that are often overlooked that might be central to the way you organize your life and see your life? So I would like to do an experiment. We'll see if it works. Since it's an experiment, we don't know. And that is, I would like you all to find a partner that's near you. Someone, choose a person near you who you're least familiar with. And just kind of find someone, just look around. But try to be quiet, just do it silently. Steve, you have someone? You have someone? Oh. Anybody need someone still? Francis? Who else? And anybody else? So why don't you make a group of three? And so first you might just tell each other your names. You guys must have long names. Very long names. So let's try to keep it a little bit quiet, because if it can be easily explode, and so let's try to keep it a little bit quiet as we do this difficult thing with so many people. So what I'd like you to do is to is for one of you to tell the other person what you hope to get from your meditation practice, from your spiritual practice, or from maybe coming here. What do you want to get from your spiritual practice? What is your aspiration there? What is the need that's being met there? So one person speak, and the other person only listens. And then I'll ring a bell, and when I ring the bell, then you stop, and you change, then the other person speaks. Okay, go ahead. Reflect a little bit for yourself that you stated what you want from it. Now, what, based on that desire, that want, or what you hope to get from your spiritual meditation practice, what's left out? What would be the shadow? What would be that which is unacceptable, given what you want from your practice? So why don't you now take the first person to start again. Yes. and then switch. Come back and take your places. So you might take a few moments to be quiet now. Maybe close your eyes. And feel how you're feeling now. Energetically, emotionally, and whatever you're feeling now, energetically or emotionally or state of mind, where do you feel it primarily in the body? What is the general location of that sense? Feel it and allow it to be there. It would be interesting to hear now from maybe a few people how that was like to do that, especially the second exercise of what was left out or what was unacceptable. You certainly were willing. There was pretty much a lot of energy before. Yes?
I was going to say that by revealing the unacceptable part, something that was assumed to be completely unacceptable, that all of a sudden it was more of a question about whether it really was so unacceptable after all.
Great.
Just sort of a little bit of sneaking doubt underneath it. maybe it really would be okay.
Yes.
People in my
group. She felt a sense of loving kindness to the people in the group. She was in a group of three.
I felt, as you said, there was a lot of energy, and I felt that strongly. I felt it mostly at the top of my head and somewhere in the region of my heart. And I think that just any sharing between two people where you get a relationship that wasn't there before is a very energizing and positive experience. And that's how I felt.
Someone else. I'm particularly interested in hearing about the second piece about the unacceptable or the that which is left out. The first time. Yes.
For me, it was unconsciousness would be the unacceptable thing, especially the kind of unconsciousness of doing action to avoid feeling things, you know, kind of to avoid being depressed or to avoid insecurity.
Great. Bonnie.
Yeah, in figuring out sort of what was the shadow of what it was that I wanted from doing this practice, just in saying it, I realized, oh, I really don't want that. It was what I wanted eventually is a sense of peace and equanimity, just sort of regardless of whatever's going on, that go with the flow. And then the shadow of that, I thought, was the absence, continued absence of equanimity, and sort of turmoil coming up now and then, or whatever, about things that are happening or not happening. Just identifying, I realized, well, this really, that's not okay with me. And then I realized, well, that's quite a problem to have that be that's okay. It's so much not okay. But then what?
Great.
What does that do?
Thank you. So the last one, yeah.
On the shadow side, I found myself now thinking about it. That it was something I feared most to embrace. It is, in fact, what I feared most that I'm most tempted to move into.
Not because now you realize it, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Once it's seen, you're tempted to move into it.
I think it just became more conscious about. When it came up very quickly, and I was surprised when it came up. So I then, in contemplating it afterwards during this talk, I realized that those aspects of my life are the aspects of my life that I most am tempted to, in fact, embrace and take in.
It remains very, very hard for me to give up wanting to get better and better and every day better and better. I'll change what I want to get better about. at first it was I want the whole Satori experiences all the time and live and death. Gave up that idea as being an unenlightened viewpoint. So switched over to wanting other things. And I can't say that they're gone. They're just there. And I hope someone has some power, energy, has a better choice of what I'm going to get than I do.
The woman who had done the shamanic practices, part of the discussion with her was asking her, what's wrong with just being present as you are? Why do you have to get somewhere and follow a program and have all these experiences? And so she talked about it for a while, and she said that it was very important for her to follow a path and get all these progress and do all this stuff. And then she said it was very interesting if you listen to people. She said because then she did all that, then she could really be here. So I asked her, why don't you just be here to begin with? One of the questions I thought might, when I first thought of this kind of exercise, I actually thought of a different question. And that was, what you wanted from the Sangha, from the community you practice with. And then having stated that, what's the shadow side of that? What's unacceptable there? So you might think about that on your own, since we're not going to do that as an exercise, because we're running out of time. People are giggling.
I said it's also a dangerous question.
Well, I hope some of you think about it. So the end of suffering, which is what Buddhism offers, is not the banishment of anything. It's not the banishment of that which is negative or painful in our life, or our negativity. But rather, if you banish it, anything gets banished becomes a hungry ghost. So what are your hungry ghosts, and then how do you feed them? Because they need to be fed, but you can't feed them through the mouth, because the mouth is too small. And one of the most powerful ways to feed them is through your awareness, to become aware of them carefully. Be aware of them carefully and respectfully, and then see what happens.
Which is what Brahma did.
Which is what Brahma did, yeah. So I'll end with this famous quote by Rilke in Letters to a Young Poet. "We have no reason to harbor any mistrust against our world, for it is not against us. If it has terrors, they are our terrors. If they have abysses, these abysses belong to us. If there are dangers, we must try to love them. If only we arrange our life in accordance with the principle which tells us that we must always trust in the difficult, then what now appears to us as the most alien will become our most intimate and trusted experience. How could we forget those ancient myths that stand at the beginning of all races, the myths about dragons that at the last moment are transformed into princesses? Perhaps all the dragons in our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us act, just once, with beauty and courage. Perhaps everything that frightens us is, in its deepest essence, something helpless that wants our love. So you mustn't be frightened. If sadness rises in front of you, larger than you have ever seen, if anxiety, like light and cloud shadows, moves over your hands and over everything you do, you must realize that something is happening to you, that life has not forgotten you, that it holds you in its hands and will not let you fall. Why do you want to shut out your life and uneasiness, out of your life any uneasiness, any misery, any depression, since after all, you don't know what work these conditions are doing inside of you?" So bring your awareness to them all. That's kind of what we do. So enjoy your Halloween, and you might spend tomorrow reflecting on what is, and you might speak the unspeakable, speak the unspoken, and see the unseen, at least for one day. Good luck.